Hello and welcome to The Signal. I'm Sarah Krimolowski.
And I'm Gabrielle Brunette. We're with the audio workshop at the University of King's College School of Journalism.
Today on the show, virtual waiting rooms and downloadable prescriptions.
Request care. Select get care to continue.
How Nova Scotians without family doctors are getting healthcare online.
And money matters. The Dalhousie budget proposal has many students feeling the pinch.
Dal says a lot about wanting to consult students and wanting students to be part of these decisions, and they can say that all they want and their actions don't match, and they haven't for a very long time.
Our feature interview with the Dalhousie Student Union president. We'll hear how potential tuition hikes are squeezing students.
And we'll hear how small communities are saving their volunteer fire halls thanks to an online 50-50 draw that's, well, on fire and blowing up.
Plus later, we'll hear from a Nova Scotian mom who's making a political decision to teach her daughter Acadian French.
It is hard. Making this choice to speak Acadian French means that I am choosing to put my daughter in a position where she is going to have to defend her French.
All that and more on today's show.
Your doctor is your phone, your computer? Last summer, Nova Scotia Health partnered with technology company Maple so that people in Nova Scotia without family doctors can get healthcare online. I checked in to see how that's going.
Request care. Select get care to continue.
For Jocelyn Hart, this is what a doctor's visit is like. The Annapolis Valley resident has been looking for a family doctor for over 3 years. But last fall, she got an invitation to sign up for the Virtual Care NS system. She decided to try it out.
In November when I first used Maple, mm-hmm. and that was the first health care I've had in over 3 years since my family doctor retired.
Hart is not alone. More than 80,000 Nova Scotians don't have family doctors. The Virtual Care NS pilot project is meant to be the next best thing. Nelson Ventura is a manager of health innovation at Nova Scotia Health. He says the project is going well so far.
Overall, the feedback has been very positive, which is fantastic.
Hart's experience was more of a mixed bag.
I mean, at first, yeah, it was great. Like when I, you know, because it was only a few minutes after I'd put in the request. And then I was talking to a doctor.
But getting follow-up care on the app was harder.
And then it took me a month to get my results from my x-ray so that I could do a follow-up. And I just feel that, yeah, it would be so much easier if, you know, I had an actual doctor.
Stuart Gray is an e-health strategist at Doctors Nova Scotia. He says that he's optimistic that Nova Scotia will have more family doctors soon.
I think we've heard a lot of positive things from this new government.
One thing he'd like to see is centralized medical records so doctors can access information about patients no matter where they last got treated.
It would be the optimal view is to have continuity of care throughout, but our physicians do a good job of reacting to situations where new patients appear with different problem sets. I mean, they're all very skilled at that.
Ventura says that virtual care isn't meant to be a replacement for a family doctor.
It's an interim measure, and we know that having that family physician is kind of key and of utmost importance, but we just want to ensure that we also have kind of an additional option in the interim while that's being kind of sorted out.
For Hart, this can't come fast enough. She has 4 appointments coming up this month, which are a mix of in-person and on-virtual care.
Better than nothing, I guess.
She's still looking for a family doctor.
That was Jocelyn Hart. NS Health says they hope everyone on the wait list for a family doctor will be invited to use virtual care by the end of March. So far, about 55,000 people have received an email invitation, 15,000 have signed up, and about a third of those have had appointments.
Rural communities across Nova Scotia rely on volunteer fire departments. But during COVID, they've struggled to do the community fundraising that keeps them alive. John Marshall has the story of a creative online solution that's helped ease the strain and brought communities together to support their fire hall.
There are more than 6,000 volunteer firefighters in Nova Scotia. They respond to emergencies in their communities, everything from chimney fires to heart attacks. For years, they supported themselves through community events like potluck dinners and in-person draws. Beth Edwards is an executive director of the Nova Scotia Fire Services Association.
So their fundraising efforts years ago, before the pandemic, were meals, were holding their own little 50-50 kind of in-house, like Chase the Ace, that sort of thing. You know, pretty much any fundraising efforts, twice a year they'd have like a bang-up roast beef dinner. But as you can imagine, that's a lot of work too.
A lot of work, and not possible during COVID restrictions. Edwards says a new online 50-50 raffle is the perfect solution for fire halls that can't fundraise. And it's caught fire. A community-organized solution to the problem. People can buy tickets to support their local fire hall. Anyone can participate. The winner gets half the pot. With community backing, the raffle has earned large sums of money for fire halls. Beth Edwards.
First of all, it's administered through the Firefighters Association of Amherst, and they're doing a great job of it. Who came up with it? Who knows? It's not the point, but it's raising a lot of money. And around Christmas, the winner took almost $1 million. So how it works is you can pick, like, say, your ticket. You want, like, a book of 20, a book of 100 for 50, you know. So say Beth picks, I want 20 tickets. So, you know, the winner will get 10 of that. But then I have to go down. I have to pick which fire department I want that, if you will, $10 to go to, right? Who gains the benefit?
Volunteer fire halls in Nova Scotia make up a majority of the province's fire coverage. They are typically run through community associations. Edwards says the raffle has given them buying power they simply didn't have before.
I think it was down the South Shore. Enough people contributed to theirs, and within a month, they had enough cash to write a check for a new ATV and a trailer for rescue. So that would have taken them years of fundraising, like, say, boots on the ground through their own little raffles or, you know, whatever. How this came to be was, I think, because of the pandemic, and the success of it is really off the charts.
In recent weeks, the 50-50 jackpot has been close to $300,000. It's a win-win. For The Signal, I'm John Marshall.
You're listening to The Signal on CKDU 88.1 FM in Halifax. And at SignalHFX on Twitter. You can also hear us on SoundCloud. Just search King's Radio Room.
We are bringing you stories from the audio workshop at the University of King's College School of Journalism. I'm Sarah Krimilewski.
And I'm Gabrielle Brunette. Still to come on the show, our feature interview with the president of the Dalhousie Student Union. She reacts to the news that the university is looking for a 3% increase in tuition.
Plus, we'll hear why some Acadian families are taking their children's French language training into their own hands. Freeze the fees! That's the rallying cry of those opposing Dalhousie's latest budget proposal that includes a 3% hike in tuition. I spoke to Dal Student Union President Madeline Stinson about what that increase would mean for students.
What are your overall impressions of the draft operating budget that was released by the Dal budget? Okay.
I would say my overall impression is that yet again, student consultation was a box to check, not a meaningful integration into Dalhousie's budget. Students are allowed to submit consultation to the Budget Advisory Committee at Dal until February 16th, but we've already seen their proposed budget fees or the proposed budget for next year and the associated increase in fees. So it seems like they've already made their decision, and I don't fully understand why they would come forward with a fee proposal until hearing from students. It just shows that Dal says a lot about wanting to consult students and wanting students to be part of these decisions and wanting to be an institution that cares about and listens to their students, but they can say that all they want and their actions don't match, and they haven't for a very long time.
Okay, so the biggest thing that we saw in the budget that would impact students is the 3% tuition increase. So what are you hearing from students about that?
Students are very unhappy, understandably. And I think there's an added level of why, considering the last 2 years and the pandemic and how it's changed the university experience and the learning experience. Students are feeling frustrated that their university career seems to be in this uncertain place because of the pandemic, and yet Dal is so certain that they're offering an exceptional experience to the point where they need to keep increasing fees. And just like we hear every year, there are students who say, this is going to be the difference between me going to Dal and not going to Dal. I may not be able to finish my degree. I may have to take out a loan I can't afford. I may have to cut down on how much food I'm eating. I may have to move into an apartment with even more roommates. I may have to give up X part of my current life. And those are just things students shouldn't have to sacrifice. I think there's a really unnecessary, I guess, expectation of students to just accept that they live in poverty and choose to thrive and not ask for or expect anything more, which makes no sense to me, because we don't expect that of other people in different stages of their career. So I don't think that it makes sense for this continued conversation of, well, that's just what it costs to be a student. You just have to accept that. You need to, you know, pull yourself up by the bootstraps, work a little harder. Like, school does not cost what it cost in 1980. It's a much different experience, and those same, I guess, values or strategies to afford an education and still afford to be a human who deserves a decent quality of life is not relevant, nor is it appropriate.
Who is this really going to affect the most?
The fee increase will impact international students the most, in that they will see a 3% increase, but also an extra 14, I want to say 73, in a differential fee. So they'll be paying that 3% and then an additional 1470 something. And so obviously that's the biggest ticket cost, but also international students don't qualify for the same funding that domestic students do. They face additional barriers to securing housing, to financial security. Their student experience is different. Just being an international student costs more. And then when you come back to domestic students, this is going to impact those students facing financial insecurity, dealing with other barriers to accessing a higher education, students who are first to go to university, people who are former individuals in care, people who are part of the BIPOC community. It's going to impact everyone, but it's going to impact the people who need this the least, the most.
And so going back to the budget, say that what they're getting from the government of Nova Scotia is not enough to offset their additional costs, including pandemic related costs. Do you think that is a good reason for a tuition increase?
I think the fact that Nova Scotia funding to post-secondary as a sector, highlighting that it's too low, is accurate and a good point, but it's not a good enough response to increasing tuition. Yes, our province needs to put more money into post-secondary. We probably need to divide the portfolios that are post-secondary and healthcare, which are currently in one, meaning they have to, they have one pool of money for healthcare and post-secondary education, and they have to decide where it goes. And during a pandemic, and I mean, just in Nova Scotia in general, most of that money goes to healthcare, not post-secondary ed. Dal did receive money from the province because of the pandemic. So blaming on the pandemic, fair, but also like you did receive some money. And it avoids the whole fact that Dalhousie purposely built a revenue model that requires them to charge students an increasing amount in tuition to sustain what they want to do. And it avoids the necessary conversation that we have to look at that revenue model and we have to look at our budget model and how we're spending. Because if your faculty and your students don't agree with how you're spending your money, I'm sorry, you're an institution that only exists because of faculty and students. Who are you to not listen to them and not put them into the conversation? Like, it just shows how disjointed the university is from the university community. There's an institution and a community, and at Dalhousie, those two terms don't refer to the same thing.
How would you like to see that revenue model change?
I want to see the university take a larger stance on advocating with the province for more post-secondary education funding. So the amount of money that comes from the government needs to increase, the amount of money that comes from tuition revenue needs to decrease, and we need to look at alternative revenue streams. We need to take a look at our advancement office and see if we can be improving the way that we work with partners and alumni to help finance certain things in the university. We just need to, and you know, I don't have the perfect answer. I'm a fifth year Bachelor of Management student. I'm not qualified to restructure a university's budget, but I do know that I go to a university, which is supposed to be for this kind of discussion. We're supposed to use the knowledge we have to solve big problems. And so I know that there are people on this campus who could be a part of that conversation if they weren't cut out of it every year.
Thanks so much for talking to us.
No problem. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Madeline Stinson is the president of the Dalhousie Student Union. Students have until February 16th to submit their feedback to the budget proposal. Information can be found on the DSU's website.
Recently, I came across a tweet thread about local moms teaching their kids Acadian words, trying to take back their language. I talked to one of them to find out why.
No, so c'est un couvert.
So c'est un couvert.
Lisa Spini Hutton is an Acadian mom. When her daughter was born, she made the decision to speak Acadian French with her. She says it's beautiful to hear how her now five-year-old uses the words of their ancestors.
It is hard. Making this choice to speak Acadian French means that I am choosing to put my daughter in a position where she is going to have to defend her French. And at school with other Francophones, we don't live in an Acadian village, we live in Metro. It means that she'll have to explain herself a lot. But Acadian French isn't bad, and there's nothing wrong with it. And hiding that really feels like I'm admitting that there's something wrong with it.
For Spinney Hutton, this choice is political. Growing up, being told that her French was bad forced her to adjust her language in order to survive in a broader Francophone culture. As she puts it, being an Acadian is not the same as being a Francophone. There's different histories, different dialects.
And that a part of that really is the words we use, the grammar we use, our accent, as much as I can try to put it in there for her. And that's something I really want to gift her.
One of her fears as a parent is having her teachers correct her child's French. Dr. Andrea Burke-Saunier is an education professor at Université Sainte-Anne. She studies how French is taught.
I think it's important for parents, and I think it's important for teachers to discuss with students what is language insecurity, what are the different registers of language.
She wants teachers to create an environment where they can teach normalized French without demeaning other French dialects, like Acadian French. She remembers a project she did with a grade 12 French class. Students created an Acadian dictionary. She says they were excited to talk to older family members to find Acadian words. They donated the dictionary with those words to the school library.
So it let the students celebrate their words and their vocabulary, but then they were also learning, well, how else would you say gratu, or how else would you say coffee? So it's just another way of saying things.
Burke-Saunier says the teaching Spinney Hutton is doing with her daughter is important.
She broke the cycle. I'm not having my kid feel crappy about the way he speaks. I'm not seeing the end of my local parlay because people think it's not good. I'm breaking the cycle, and I'm helping my kid learn that Acadian French is okay.
Tout du lapin est un bourre dans le robe.
No.
La robe. No?
I just want people, particularly Francophones, to stop
recasting my comments to them. If you understand what I say, then you don't need to repeat it back in the way you would say it, because that sends a really clear message to me that you would prefer I say it a different way.
Oh, it's dark. Yes, Vinny.
She says she's happy to see other Acadian parents sharing their language with their kids, too. And Sarah, I'm a Francophone, but I've never thought about this before. It's great to hear this mom advocating for her language and culture.
Someone else who's advocating for the Acadian language and culture is Trevor Murphy. His latest musical project is called Sleuth, the first time he's written in French. Here's a track from their debut album. This is called Électrique. Sous l'an des abouettos, on se prépare pour la danse. 50 pièces pour ouvrir la porte et 10 larmes de pénitence. If no de Wedgeport, if no de Yarmouth, on a bien passé le monde. Project from Trevor Murphy of Quiet Parade and Dance Move.
And that's our show for today.
If there's anything you want to hear again, we post links to our stories on Twitter. Our handle is SignalHFX.
Thanks to our producer, John Marshall, and associate producer, Drew McConnell.
A shout out to our technician, Mark Pinio, in the control room.
Our audio professor is Pauline Dakin. I'm Gabrielle Brunette.
And I'm Sarah Krimlewski. We'll be back next week with more stories. Have a great weekend!